Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of December 19th, 2014. Today on the show, algorithms and where they intersect with our lives. You know what? Let's just talk to one.
Hi, Siri. I need a Christmas present for Dan.
I found quite a few gift shops fairly close to you.
This is journalism. What about a liquor store?
I found quite a few liquor stores fairly close to you.
Yeah, that's pretty good. What's the fanciest kind of scotch?
Okay, give me a moment. I found this on the web for the fanciest kind of scotch.
That's a lot of different scotches.
Okay, so what Siri was doing just then, that was a decision tree of sorts. Choosing from stores, using my location in a map, giving me scotch options. And that decision tree, that's really what an algorithm is in its simplest form. A series of decisions just made at a scale and pace beyond what a human could. We're going to explore the world of algorithms today and how they affect our daily lives. And you can come share your algorithm stories on MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
After 50 years, the U.S. and Cuba decide to normalize diplomatic relations.
The dwindling oil price is costing the Russian economy as much as $100 billion per year.
The hackers demanded Sony cancel its upcoming release of the movie The Interview, and that is what happened.
Start our show on algorithms with a story about rain. Stick with me here. On Tuesday night, producer Jody Avergan walked out of the subway in Brooklyn to find that it was pouring. The commuters who were prepared popped open their umbrellas. The others, who were damp and cold, well, an instant market appeared in front of them.
My name is Randy. I'm standing right in front of Nordstrom Bargain Store.
You got your left hand on something here.
I got my left hand on my umbrellas. Waiting for the people to pass the back to sell to them.
You may have seen this happen where you live. It starts to rain, people need umbrellas, and boom, vendors react. Randy Thomas makes the decision to move the umbrellas to the front of his store.
And just take them to the front, and as the people pass, you sell them. Yeah, as soon as it starts to rain, or a little before it starts to rain, everybody come asking, what's the price of the umbrellas, and that's when you sell them.
This is a pretty straightforward market phenomenon. You increase supply to meet demand. But it also includes the element of timing. That's when it becomes a little more sophisticated. As simple as it seems, the umbrella market is driven by an algorithm of sorts, calculated in real time. A series of decisions based on changing variables. Some vendors, Randy says he's not one of them, will even use a moment like this to jack up prices.
Nah, it remains the same.
Have you thought about it? Oh man, it's really raining right now. People are desperate.
Well, not really, because I usually keep a good stock, so I usually maintain the same price, yeah.
Decisions about supply, demand, external variables, timing, and price, all of those decisions were made by a human in one small store. But that decision tree, that's basically what a company like Amazon or Orbitz does, just on a huge scale. Mountains of data, thousands of servers, and that model helps determine what you buy, for how much, and when. Algorithms can feel like the secret sauce for online commerce, but they were once used primarily by massive corporations. Guru Hariharan, who used to work at Amazon, now runs a company that makes algorithms accessible to lots of businesses. It's called Boomerang Commerce, and he explains to me how it helps his clients sell products, increase their profits, and compete.
What the company does is we look at a lot of parameters out on the internet, and what we do is we look at the demand signals from a variety of angles and price the products in such a way that you create a good balance between profits and revenues and growth in market share.
So basically, you're out there saying, we can look at all this stuff, crunch the numbers really quickly, and tell you what your product should cost.
That's right. So let me give you a quick example. Back in the day when a retailer used to manage 10,000 products, what this retailer used to do is they would sit together in a room in about once in 3 months and say, how are we going to price these products? Fast forward 10 years, we've got some of the best of the breed algorithms running for the largest retailers out there on the internet, but they've started to price their products on a minute-by-minute basis. So there's just a massive divide in the capabilities of the companies and hence their ability to grow in the market.
I'm imagining what it feels like for you to pitch me on a product. Let's say I sell thousands of shoes. Come tell me why I should hire you guys.
So traditionally, if you've been selling thousands of shoes, there are two things that are happening in this world. One is the thousands is becoming millions. When you go online, on especially some of the websites like Amazon and Walmart and so on, you're seeing the assortment or the selection expanding to millions of products. It's not just hundreds or thousands of products. So the amount of data that's creating is just humongous. And it's almost impossible for a human being to sit through and look at all that data manually in Excel spreadsheets and make pricing changes for millions of products. Now let's compound that with one more thing that's happening in the market, which is the ability to change and react to market conditions on a very rapid basis.
How much data do you need to look at to be able to figure that out? I mean, how many different, you know, data points are you guys crunching?
We're looking at more than 100 to 150 data points.
Wow, more than 100.
Yes, on a minute-by-minute basis, and multiply that by about 100 million products that we are pricing. So there's just a humongous amount of data you couldn't have fathomed in the old school retail.
I've opened up your dashboard for one of the companies you work with to see what it looks like to be a client.
Yes.
And a lot of this looks like basically you're saying, here's the price you would have to set for your watches, that's the company I'm looking at, to undercut Amazon's price, be a little bit above it. You know, it looks like a great big pinwheel.
So in this situation, the watch company that we're looking at, there are certain watches where customers have been price comparing on Google Shopping and so on. And it is in the best interest for this retailer to be highly competitive on this product set. However, some other watches, they were not price comparing. Maybe they were exclusive vendors, and they in those situations, we may be using those products to make higher profits. The summary of all of this is that we are able to use algorithms to go out and balance revenues and profits for this retailer.
I'm looking at a chart of watches, and it's fascinating to me. There's a men's blue dial 18-karat gold-plated watch that Amazon sells for $108.76. Your client sells it for $94.99. And I imagine that's because you looked at it and said, you guys can do better here if, you know, you offer this for less money because this one is, what, price sensitive?
That's right. That's exactly right. We saw that this particular watch, we were able to drive a very high amount of revenue and profits at $94. And we found, the algorithms found that this was the sweet spot where the customer demand was so high that it was completely worth giving almost a 50% discount on this particular watch in order to maximize revenues and profits. For this particular watch that you mentioned, we looked at their price on about 15 different websites. We looked at what is the price on Google, the top-selling websites on Google. Then we looked at what is the cost of procurement for this watch. We looked at what is the fulfillment cost for this watch. We also computed things like elasticity. If I change this price of the watch by $5, how does a competitor react to it?
Your customers are still pretty big companies. Do you think there's going to be a day where a small retailer, you know, mom and pop retailer, is using algorithms and looking at data this way?
Absolutely. I think the sooner that retailers are able to, whether big or small, they're able to realize that they can use algorithms and modern techniques to drive retail, they'll be able to win and survive and capture market share.
If you're a customer, though, how do you know that the algorithm is getting the best price for you versus, say, you know, wringing a few more dollars out of you?
I think this is an age where the customer is going to win regardless of whatever we do. Price transparency is so high right now. When you walk into a store, you have access to your smartphone where you can pull it up and check prices on hundreds of websites on the internet. When you're surfing on the web, sitting on your couch, you can pull up something like a Google shopping engine to go out and look at products all across the internet, and it'll just give side-by-side comparisons. So the price transparency, it exceeds any time in the history of retail that customers have today.
But if you look at an algorithm like, say, Uber's, that's an area where customers feel like they don't win because the algorithm is responding to supply and demand.
So I think that's a great question you have. Some of the algorithms, like what Uber uses, it's not just to capitalize on the demand and charge customers higher prices. It is actually to increase supply.
But don't you understand where I think a lot of people get nervous that supply and demand is being calculated by computers and by math, that I think makes people uncomfortable? They can feel like the algorithm is cheating them.
If Uber, for instance, were charging higher prices mainly to make profits, then over time, over the course of, like, say, 6 to 12 months, what will happen is that customers are not going to go back to Uber. They're going to find a different way to get from point A to point B. Like today, it was a rainy day out here in the Silicon Valley. I had to take a cab today to come to work. My car broke down. I wanted to call an Uber. On an average day, it would have been very difficult for me to find a taxi at this point. But what Uber has done now is that by increasing the prices, they have increased the supply on the roads of taxis. Because they just increased the prices by about 25% to 30%, and more Uber service providers are able to get on the roads.
But how much more did you have to pay?
I had to pay about 20% extra, but you know what? I was completely fine with that rather than having to miss this interview.
Guru Haraharan is the CEO of Boomerang Commerce. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of Marketplace Weekend. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and that couldn't have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate to Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. Thank you so much for your support. This week, we're focusing on algorithms in our lives and now in love.
Online dating, not a big fan of it.
Because it just seems like rejection, rejection, rejection.
We live a very busy life. It allows people to still meet someone who might be interested in them.
My parents got married off there, so
if I was older and I didn't really have time to go out and date around.
I think Tinder is a hot mess right now.
It turned me into a kind of a sex addict.
Whatever it takes to find love, I'm constantly meeting people. Constantly.
It kind of was like a totally different dating pool than my small town.
I actually did meet a boyfriend online. I mean, we ended up moving in together 6 months later, and it was really great. You know, until it wasn't. So
it's a problem sometimes in life with too many choices.
When we create these profiles, we're sort of creating these ideals of ourselves, like the person that we want to be.
Meeting a lot of people, there are a lot of opportunity, but they are not sincere.
They would lie about everything. Oh, I'm a lawyer. Not really a lawyer. I work at, you know, the dry cleaners, which is fine.
It's going to be a totally different thing, dating, in the future.
Algorithms are everywhere online, but they may be at their most intimate on dating sites. Dating sites and apps are everywhere these days, even in the palm of your hand, and we've all grown accustomed to trusting these algorithms to set us up. I spoke with Christian Rutter, one of the founders of the site OkCupid, about how much faith we should put in algorithms to find us an attractive partner online.
Oh, that we can do very well. But that's different than people that you might actually want to talk to. Attractive people, that's very easy. We can just look up our 100 most attractive users.
People to whom you are attractive.
Exactly. That's a little more complicated. We try to show you people that we think we're likely that you'll talk to. philosophically, I think after that, we believe the rest is kind of up to you, whether you're going to go on a date, whether the date goes well, whether you like the person, all that stuff. There, we can't control that. You can have a beautiful profile, be perfect on paper. You all like the same bands, all that stuff. All the boxes are checked. You know, and algorithms can only see whether boxes are being checked. But then you sit down, somebody's laugh is annoying. They remind you of your sister. You know, there's just a million things that can go wrong or right on a date that a computer is just not going to be able to capture.
So sell it to me. What can it do for me that a friend can't?
We know a lot more people than your friends. We have access to a lot more information about those people than your friends. And we can give you a way to talk to people that's relatively safe. You know, you don't have to put yourself out there. Your friend can set you up on a blind date. You got to drag your butt to the restaurant, psych yourself up, put on your clothes, you know, trim your nose hairs or whatever it is. No offense. You know, get yourself together and decide if you're going to like this person before you've even talked. You know, online, you can browse through some people, send a few messages, send a bunch of messages, see who you hit it off with, and then kind of pick from there. And you can do that on your own time. You can do it without exposing yourself to too much rejection, although obviously rejection is part of it. It's another way that the internet has made life more convenient in some ways.
Yeah. And yet the flip side of that is that often it can magnify the rejection because you're thinking, wait a minute, isn't this computer supposed to know stuff about me? If these people who were sort of picked for me don't like me, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that could be considered a failing in our algorithm, but there's so many things about human beings that we don't know and therefore could never predict or try to sort for you. I'm not going to tell you that online dating has taken all the pain out of romance and made it as easy as clicking a button, but it's definitely changed it, and I think in some ways very positively, and yeah, obviously in some ways more negatively.
What about honesty? I mean, one of the sort of virtues of the internet that is often extolled is transparency, but I guess an algorithm can't screen for liars, can it?
It's all fact-checked in a certain way. Like, you know, I'm whatever, 5'10", maybe 5'11", with a little bit of stretch. And I can't sit there in my online dating profile and pretend that I'm 6'4", pretend that I'm like super muscular or whatever, that I'm a rocket scientist or some of this stuff. Because I got to meet people and be myself. You're kind of only screwing yourself. Online dating is one of the few digital things that is really meant to affect a real world outcome. You know, it's not like you're just tweeting at people, you know, in the ether. You know, you're supposed to meet in person and sleep together, get married, hate each other, who knows? But you can only misrepresent yourself so far. I might round up to 6 feet just to get over some certain thresholds, but people do that in person all the time also, you know, add money to their income, all that kind of thing.
Wear heels.
Sure, Spanx. as online dating has become just dating, it has the same sort of problems.
When I think about the spectrum of different online dating options that are out there, there's, you know, Tinder, which is basically no algorithm whatsoever. That's, is this person attractive or not? And then at the other end, maybe eHarmony, which says we can run you through a gazillion different variables and find your soulmate. Where do you guys come down? And why did you choose to do it that way?
We're probably 2/3 of the way towards Tinder, I'd say. I mean, obviously we have an algorithm that we spend a lot of time optimizing. But we really created OkCupid almost as an answer to the eHarmony way of doing things. You know, we started the site back in 2003. They were one of, if not the biggest kind of player. And we just thought it was so prescriptive. There's this long questionnaire. You've got to go through the whole thing. They've decided what is important, what isn't. You know, most famously, if you're interested in same-sex relationships, they don't want you on the site. And we made OkCupid. We wanted to have all these questions and all this stuff, but we left it open. You don't have to answer many if you don't want to. And you decide what's important to you. You weight the questions. Like, if you care about religion, give it a high rating. If you don't, don't. And then eHarmony is, I think, fatal flaw for me, and I think for a lot of people, is that at the end of all this, they give you a few people. Here are your matches today, your five or whatever it is. And if you don't want to talk to them, tough, wait till tomorrow. You know, whereas on OkCupid, you can browse the entire site. You can kind of keep sorting, changing for yourself. Tinder does have an algorithm. It's the algorithm that's in every person's head, which is good. And that's how you ultimately are going to decide who you're going to be with. We kind of try to compromise between the two things. We have some of the underlying question and answer mechanics of eHarmony, but we recognize, we kind of leave the final power with people.
And really, it's based on, I guess you could say, multiple algorithms, because not just what you guys wrote and coded, but also an internal preference sort of according to every individual who's on there.
Right, yeah. People give their own weights. They give their own desired answers. So in a way, we kind of made a platform for people to make their own algorithm. I mean, we don't present it like that because that would confuse a lot of people and probably cost us a lot of users who don't want to think like that. But essentially, that's what we've done.
What's your reaction to the sort of algorithm as Big Brother and or slightly demonized phenomenon? Because you're a little skeptical of data everywhere.
The thing I'm skeptical about is people treating algorithms as facts. They need to recognize, and they should recognize, they're the opinion of programmers who wrote it, right? You know, which, and like any human opinion, can be fallible. You know, for instance, just I like to bring up the Netflix example because people are a lot less invested about what movie they're going to watch. But it's basically the same thing, though. So, you know, they offer a prize to improve on their algorithm. You know, it's beatable. It always will be beatable by definition. These things will never be perfect.
Christian Rutter is a founder of OkCupid and the author of Dataclysm, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Where do you think you're going? Well, I'm not going that way. It's much too rocky. You'll be malfunctioning within a day, you nearsighted scrap pile. And don't let me catch you following me, begging for help, because you won't get it.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So this show is about algorithms, and we've done a lot of tech in real life on the show today, but you are going to take us a little deeper. Your
yes.
favorite algorithm story ever.
Yes. So this has to do with AdWords, right, which is what Google uses to deliver ads to people.
Okay.
This is Google's way of finding advertisements that are fraudulent.
Got it. Okay.
And so Google uses an algorithm to do this. It's been built by engineers, and it has an aspect of machine learning in it. So it sort of pulls in a bunch of data and then learns from that data and then uses that data to flag advertising that's fraudulent, that doesn't look right, that's fake, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So what happened was Google engineers discovered that the algorithm was flagging a bunch of photos that it didn't really understand why they were being flagged. As near as they could tell, there was nothing wrong with these photos. They were
photos of
cars that were for sale. Now, as they pushed further and further into this and did some more digging, they discovered that the algorithm was identifying photos of cars that the algorithm thought were somehow not legit for sale in China.
And the algorithm knew?
Well, this is what's weird. There's a common scam that happens in China in certain places where someone will take a photo of a car, say, this car is for sale. They'll put it up online and say, you know, come meet me at this time and I'll sell you this car. And it's not their car. It's just a car that's being parked in the neighborhood. And someone will show up with the money to buy the car. And then this person will have his buddy or her buddy steal the car, exchange cash for the vehicle, and then disappear.
So how did the algorithm identify these cars?
So it was using a bunch of metadata, which we know is this information that's attached to photos that are posted online, things like that. And because of the amount of data that it was pulling in, it could tell which of the photos of cars were for legit sales and which seemed to be being posted by people who were planning on stealing those cars.
Because the metadata sort of winked and said, hey, I'm not a legit guy.
Yeah, basically, and sort of identified aspects of either the user who was posting the photo or the photos being posted in a certain area, being attached to information about car theft, things like that.
This goes so far beyond what we've been talking about on the show today because it seems that the algorithm was, for lack of a better word, learning.
Yes, learning, and I guess in a way you could almost say predicting the future, right? Which is very bizarre.
But if you think about maybe fraudulent behavior online, I mean, a lot of us tell little white lies to the algorithm. We just talked about online dating on the show, for example. I'm not sure all those profiles are legit.
Yes, yes. Definitely. Or maybe I buy a present for my 4-year-old nephew online and then Amazon or Google starts delivering me advertising as if I were a dad instead of just an uncle or something like that. But here's the thing. The more powerful algorithms get, the more of a machine learning aspect they have built in, the better they are at minimizing errors like this. And they're getting actually really good at this. And I think that's potentially a good thing, right? Because it means advertising that's more useful, maybe more accurate representations of who we are online, stuff like that.
This brings us back to the part of algorithms that makes people nervous.
Yes.
The idea that some machine, if you will, I'm attributing it to many human qualities, but that it knows a lot about us.
Yes. And look, Lizzie, we've both seen Terminator. I'm as scared as you are, right? But here's the thing. What we want to do is build in safeguards so that algorithms don't make definitive wrong decisions by themselves. We want to build in ways in which we can look at the information that's being presented to us and without assuming the guilt of, for instance, a car thief or someone who's posting photos of cars in China without at least examining it as a human being ourselves.
So we've talked today about how algorithms mirror decisions made by humans just on a much larger scale. I guess this is saying maybe leave some decisions to the humans?
Yes, at least for now, Lizzie. I think we should keep some human factor in there.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're talking about algorithms this week, and some of them are already doing human jobs. At the Associated Press, computer programs with specialized algorithms are writing company earnings reports. Other financial media outlets, including Forbes, are trying this too. In fact, this year we saw one of these algorithms write about the streaming music company Pandora, which means, essentially, an algorithm was writing about an algorithm. So what does all this mean for how you get the news? Here's Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Sepulveda.
There are several companies that have developed or are developing algorithms and programs that can write news reports. And Natasha Samrini worked for one of them. She was a Chicago-based editor for Narrative Science, and she says that company was just your stereotypical tech startup. Like her and her coworkers would all hang out after work and drink beers.
And there's a keg in the kitchen, and we have these fun little contests, you know, improve team spirit, where they ask people, you know, what would you want your conference rooms to be named after? And I think the top runners were Star Wars and Top Gun characters.
Samrini says when her coworkers weren't geeking out, they were developing an algorithm that takes huge amounts of data, whittles it down, and presents it. Now, in one way or another, financial, sports, and other data has been aggregated for years by lots of different companies. But Samrini says there was one thing that made her company different.
So Narrative Science, the big deal was that, you know, it really sounded like the language came from a person instead of a robot.
That it, Samrini is talking about, is news. Algorithms wrote the news. And there are two big companies that do this, Narrative Science and Automated Insights. Both of those companies didn't return multiple calls for comment, but their work has been praised by news analysts, in part because it's so fast. These algorithms can turn complex data sets into stories in just seconds. As Mark Rogowski explains, algorithms are more efficient at organizing important facts.
That's a fair question. I think most of this is a force for good.
Rogowski is a Silicon Valley tech writer for Forbes, which happens to be one of the companies that uses narrative science. Rogowski says he's not worried at all about an algorithm taking his job. In fact, from an efficiency standpoint, he says algorithms can be wonderful things, precisely because it helps clear up workers' time.
There's been a discussion as to whether or not sort of the computers are going to take our jobs away, right? But the answer is it's really tricky. We're sort of on the cusp of what might actually be a revolution. So when I hear former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers worried about how the jobs may not come back this time from automation, I think, well, maybe we don't really need the jobs to come back this time.
For journalists, those jobs include recaps of sporting events or stock performances, really basic rote reporting. But those jobs are often entry level, and they come with entry level salaries. So financially, why is this algorithm-based reporting attractive to the AP or Forbes or the LA Times when those workers get paid so little?
Well, the core of it, I think, is advertising and where advertising is going.
Rick Edmonds is a media business faculty professor at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. And while we couldn't get a price for how much these services charge, Edmonds says they're probably much cheaper than your entry-level salary. Meanwhile, he says ad rates for print issues or broadcasts are really, really high. But
you go to the web, you know, each of those is less. You go down to the mobile smartphone format, that's even less. So you have to have a variety of new products.
Products that keep people clicking on the digital space. Yet because the revenues are much lower for that space, the product has to be a lot cheaper. Enter the algorithm. And while these algorithms create dynamic content for the digital space, Edmonds says you get what you pay for. He says these algorithm-created reports tend to be pretty bland.
It's pretty easy to determine which stories clearly were the product of human input, human thought.
I decided to test that theory out. I got together with two guys from Portland, Oregon, who work in media. Their names are John Connolly and Jim Sandberg. I read them two different stories. When I'm done reading the stories, I say, hey, which one of these, A or B, was written by a computer? John Connolly went first.
Yeah, I think A was done by a robot.
I did have the feeling that A was a bit more robotic. It seemed like it was just spewing off data.
Yeah, and those are pretty dry articles.
So both those stories were written by robots.
They're terrible stories.
Yeah, I mean,
I, for one, welcome our new benevolent robot overlords.
Maybe the Poynter Institute's Rick Edmonds is right, and the human voice, even in media, can't be so easily replicated by an algorithm. In Portland, I'm John Sepulvedo for Marketplace Weekend.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're talking about algorithms this week, and we just explored what they can mean for the news business. Now, how you can beat an algorithm, or at least fight back. We're going to talk to the chief data scientist for the airfare site Hopper in a second. But first, we'll hear your secrets to beating the airfare system.
If you go to the internet, you can find good deals.
Internet. It's
online.
Online,
as far as I know.
Online.
I can compare another company.
You hire an agent.
An agent?
I booked the whole package together. It was just easier.
But you generally have to do it like a couple months before your travel date.
And usually a few days before too, it gets cheaper because they try to get the flights sold.
I typically go to the carriers directly. If it's an established route that I travel frequently, I know which carrier I'm going to fly.
Tuesday afternoons around 12 p.m.-ish.
It depends on where, you know, what the season is. Like now, I'm sure it's cheap to go to Hawaii considering it's wintertime.
I think it's cheaper. For example, this year I am flying to the East Coast, but I'm actually flying on Christmas Day and returning on New Year's Day because the tickets were about 10 to 15% cheaper that way. No one wants to travel on those days, but when you're buying for a family of four, it starts to add up.
Hello, hello, hello. That's no big secret. Everybody basically on the planet who travels has figured that out. You hit the internet and get the best deals.
You hit the internet and get the best deals. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit. Joining me now is Patrick Suri, Chief Data Scientist at Hopper.com. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
It's great to be here.
All right, so is that true? You hit the internet and get the best deals? It feels like it might be more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think people find it's really frustrating. What we hear from consumers is that it's one of the most confusing things that a consumer purchases, not to mention one of the priciest.
So if you're trying to buy a plane ticket, how many different algorithms are you up against on any different weekday afternoon?
The airlines have got very sophisticated at what they call revenue management or yield management. They, you know, they try to extract the maximum.
Making money?
Exactly. They try to sell each seat for the most they possibly can. You know, their big challenge is that the people who are willing to pay the most for the tickets don't know that they want the ticket until right before they have to travel, that being the business people.
So when you guys use data, how do you do that and then do analysis to figure out what's the best time to travel or the best time to buy?
So really what we're doing is we're watching prices that are found by people all over the internet. So we see every day 3 or 4 billion prices of trips all over the world. And what we do is use that information to try to figure out how the prices of different kinds of trips vary so that we can help consumers understand the best way to buy their own trip.
One of those voices we heard was someone saying, oh, the best day is Tuesday at noon. Well, why do people have these very specific ideas about kind of how to beat the system?
Well, people want to understand. I think, you know, people are so frustrated. Your gas price goes up and down, but your neighbor doesn't pay, you know, a third of what you did just because you went to the wrong gas station. So people want to have simple rules and they want advice about how they can get a deal and feel like they didn't, you know, pay more than the person sitting next to them on the plane. The idea about buying on a Tuesday, you know, that's one of those simple rules you hear over and over again. The other one is how far ahead should I book? You know, how many days ahead of my trip? And the problem is that there just isn't a simple rule. You have to look at each individual trip you want to take.
What are some common mistakes you've seen people make when they try and do this?
So I think three big things that people do is, you know, they procrastinate because they're confused. They don't do the homework and figure out what is a good price for the ticket so that they can buy it when they see the price. People also don't often think about the total cost of the flight. And that's increasingly important because airlines have started unbundling all these extra services. So you show up at the airport, you've got to pay for your carry-on, you've got to pay for your bag, you've got to pay for your snack.
Let's engage in a theoretical exercise. I know, for example, that I'm going to go to Brazil at the end of January. How do I get the best deal on that? And what are the things that go into that?
The key thing that we always say is the more flexibility you have, the more opportunities you have to save. So figure out your potential destinations, and that might not just be the, you know, the city you need to get to in the end. My family and I saved a ton of money last summer getting to Europe. You know, we needed to get to the UK, but we ended up buying tickets to Portugal because they were half price.
Wow.
So this kind of flexibility is the way that you can work against the airlines, I guess, because, you know, they think about each route individually. And as a consumer, you can often benefit from that because one route is much more competitive than another.
One of the amazing things that my producer pointed out to me was that you guys found that canceling your flight and rebooking can actually save you money. How does that work?
So this is a little known fact that the U.S. Department of Transportation actually requires that every domestic and even foreign airline that sells tickets to U.S. consumers must allow them to cancel their ticket within 24 hours for a full refund. So what we did is we went and looked at our data and said, you know, okay, if we take the first price that we saw for a ticket and then watch for 24 hours on that particular trip, how often does the price go down? And we were amazed that even within that 24-hour period, we often saw prices that were 10% lower than where we started out. If you've got a tool like the mobile app that we're coming out with or the tools that other people are helping to build, then, you know, maybe the consumer can use data to their own advantage to actually get a better deal on their ticket.
How do you look at all this stuff and not just go completely crazy?
I'm a data person, obviously, and for me, it's the structure that's in there, which is the interesting part. It's getting from this feeling of frustration and just randomness where you start out when you're buying tickets, and drilling into the structure of it, you find that there is lots of predictable patterns, and it's just a matter of kind of lining that up in a way that's useful to the average person. And that, for me, that's the exciting part of it.
Patrick Slurry, Chief Data Scientist at Hopper.com. Thanks so much for your time.
Great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Next week on Marketplace Weekend, we're talking about indulgence. Around the holidays, you indulge or try not to indulge in many things. Lots of temptations this time of year. We want to hear your stories about indulgence. How does it affect you financially? Or what do you try to keep from yourself? And does it work? Tell us. Write to us at marketplaceweekend.org, visit Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. These days, algorithms are often used online to track shoppers' habits and advertise, even to kids. That's something our next guest knows well. If you remember the G.I. Joe cartoons, you're going to recognize his voice. His name is Bill Ratner, and for years, his voice on TV helped market and sell toys to kids. And that eventually gave him some pause. So Ratner rethought how to bring up kids in the age of TV and smartphones and tablets. His book is called Parenting for the Digital Age. In it, he tells the story of realizing his own daughter was glued to TV.
She could handle that remote like, you know, a NASA captain handled a space capsule. So I have a dear friend who was helping me with the house, and I said, let's see if we could just rewire the entertainment system. And so I had this electric switch installed halfway down the basement in the wall that couldn't readily be seen. And when I'd say, honey, we really can't be watching television. Daddy wants to turn it off. No, you don't. I just turned, I'd go down the steps, and I'd flick the switch, and there'd be another scream, but it wouldn't be at me, it would be at the television gods. How can you do this to me, Daddy? The TV set's broken. And I'd say, oh, no. That was my first kind of, my first subterfuge at trying to control the digital media in my home with my children.
You've written this book, Parenting for the Digital Age, and it seems to me that a lot of this is really about communication and boundaries. And I'm wondering why it is that you felt you had to perform a deception on your children as opposed to just say, no, I'm the dad and these are my rules.
Blowback from your children at all ages is really rough. But those moments for parents, I think any parent listening has those moments, whether it's a tantrum from a 2-year-old or a screaming fit from a 16-year-old. Why can't I have the car?
Right, you're terrible. You're the worst. Yeah.
I hate my family. Don't you scream that at me. Okay, I hate my family. That's a real conversation I had with my then 13-year-old daughter.
A lot of parents worry about this stuff, and yet I don't think most of them have what is, I think, from your book, an internal challenge for you. Anyone listening could hear it in your voice. You have a great voice. Tell us how you make your money.
Well, I'm a voiceover guy, and I do TV cartoons. I was Flint on G.I. Joe, which every American male between the age of 32 and 48 will probably remember.
Yeah, and 138-year-old female radio host.
Oh, excellent, excellent, great. Thank you, Lizzie. This show particularly, along with Transformers at the same time, was created in the early 80s, during which time broadcasters and retail advertisers from Ford Motor Company to Hasbro to Mattel said, we need some relief. These FCC rules about not being able to advertise kids' toys within the show that has the characters, these are outdated. So the FCC relaxed rules about children's broadcasts in which action figures were never allowed to be advertised if they were characters in a show until 1982. When I went into Toys R Us and every other toy store in America in the early 80s, after we started this show, G.I. Joe, and after Transformers started as well, the amount of toys and the number of hours of commercial advertising aimed at children had skyrocketed within just about a year and a half's time. And I suddenly thought, well, gee, I love this cartoon work and then the voiceover work is fun, but I'm part of the problem.
Yeah, do you feel guilty?
No, not anymore. I created
but you
a program.
Did.
I don't know if it was guilty or it was just there was a conflict. It was like, wait a minute, I'm actually causing this. I went into the LA public schools and created a program called TV Cartoon Scandals Media Awareness for Children. I felt responsible.
The idea that the children are targets of advertisers, that seems relatively straightforward, if large, when we're talking about, say, television. But it becomes a much more nuanced and complicated thing when you add in cell phones and tablets and Facebook and all of the screens with which we interact now.
Yes.
Tell me about the rules that you came up with your own daughters, and then in these families with whom you had conversations in the writing of this book?
Well, we banned cell phones during certain hours of the day. We'd take them, and I'd literally put them in my sock drawer. There was a fascinating article, a series of articles done by a New York Times writer who interviewed Steve Jobs not long before he died. And he said, boy, your house must be an amazing place for your children. And he said, no, it's not. I banned the stuff. And he said, what do you mean? Well, I know exactly what it does. And he and his wife had devised a very, very strict control structure to keep his very inventions for the family out of his house.
You can't hit a proverbial kill switch everywhere in the world. Were there a couple of principles that you think resonated through the families that you interviewed or that people and parents can adhere to when they're trying to craft a philosophy about how they're going to move forward.
So the first element to answer your question is really time. Time to veg out. Time to stare at the sky. That was a major concern of every parent that I spoke with. Two is the fact that much of the programming and games, from games to magazines to websites, is being created by total strangers. You have no idea what their values are. So the issue is control of time, control of content.
I guess I just have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If I had your kids in the studio, what would they say about the rules you guys set and how you did?
I think they'd say, you know, what my parents did was well-intended, didn't always work.
Bill Ratner is the author of Parenting for the Digital Age. Thanks so much.
Yes, thanks, Lizzie. Really fun.
Finally, we all know one of the biggest places we come in contact with algorithms is on the internet. In the United States, the internet is an essential part of our daily lives. But in Cuba, internet access is heavily restricted to mostly a small national network on the island. That may soon change now that President Obama and Cuba are on the path to normalizing relations. Nancy Scola, a reporter covering tech policy for The Washington Post, joins us to talk about Cuba's connectivity.
One of the things that was most striking about this was that at the same time that President Obama was speaking and talking about lowering these barriers to entry for U.S. telecommunications companies, President Castro was also speaking and saying that he was opening up the country on the telecommunications front. He didn't specify whether that means just, you know, letting more computers and letting more wireless routers flow into the country, or if that actually means lowering the restrictions that they have in place that limits what Cubans can look at the internet. So some of those details are going to be shaking out, hopefully over the next few weeks and months.
You know, I think about big U.S. internet and broadband companies. What's in this for them, do you think? We're not talking about a massive financial market.
Cuba is the population of Ohio, which is not an extraordinarily big market opportunity for your big American telecom companies. I think there's some aspect to this where it's a fulfillment of what they think is their mission of bringing people online. We've seen in the last several years companies like Google, companies like Facebook, taking the millions and billions that they make and trying to open up the internet to the sort of greater part of the world. We've seen Facebook launch balloons over Africa to try to bring internet access there. So I think in some ways it's just sort of a symbolic, you know, they like the internet. They want to bring people online.
What about cost? After all, you know, the average Cuban does not make a lot of money. And what, 80% of the population works for the state?
Yeah. And, I think the average per capita income in Cuba is about $5,500 U.S. dollars. So there is a limitation there on what people are going to be able to afford. One of the questions that's raised about this is, OK, Cuba opens up the country to more internet access. So companies can now come in, build out the internet and bring people online. There's a way in which that happens, and it's just, you know, AT&T or Telefonica comes in and builds out the internet and charges people. And that could be very expensive for the average Cuban. One of the things that people are talking about in sort of telecom policy circles is, could you see the Cuban government build out the internet themselves, build out a backbone that then maybe other companies can come in and sell access? But it's, you know, in sort of a Cuban-inspired model, maybe a little more socialist model, it's much less expensive than it is in the United States, where we think of it just as sort of a consumer product. And we've seen a little bit of that happen in the United States. You see Google Fiber has come into a number of cities, Austin, yep, Kansas City, where they offer internet access for an installation fee. But after that, you get very high-speed internet for free for 10 years. So there's a possibility that, you know, as Cuba builds out its internet access, it's sort of distinctly Cuban style of internet access.
I think about the role that things like Twitter and Facebook have played in places like Iran. I wonder what we're going to see in Cuba. Will the internet be a place to foment dissent, to communicate, you know, away from the government? And how's the government going to view that?
I think there's a fair bet we'll see a restriction on services like Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. That's happened in China. That's happened in a number of countries. In China, they crack down on services like Twitter and instead prefer something called Weibo or Sina Weibo, which is a sort of more regulated, more strictly monitored sort of microblogging service. I think there's a good possibility that something like that happens in Cuba.
Nancy Scola covers tech policy for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Jody Avergan. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, Indulgence. Thanks for listening. This is APM.